The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Grammy winner Lucas Richman, director of both the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra and the Bangor Maine Symphony, as well as a composer of Jewish classical music. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The killing of Osama bin Laden has been at the top of everyone's news cycle this week, coming as it did in a stunning announcement by the president last Sunday night, keeping all the TV and blogosphere commentators awfully busy ever since. While I must admit that the execution of a cold-blooded murderer like bin Laden comes as a kind of relief, I cannot share in the jubilation that so many people seem to be demonstrating at this bold action by the U.S. Navy SEALs. It is good to know that he is out of the world, that Al-Qaeda has been damaged at least a bit, and that he will never again organize and coordinate the mass murder of civilians as he did on 9/11. It is also good to know that after nearly a decade, our military finally got its man. I'm pleased that President Obama authorized this action, and I'm relieved that apparently no American servicemen or women were injured or killed in the attack. More strongly, I also hope that some of the families of the victims of the 9/11 attacks feel some sense of justice or relief. And well, that's about it. A few stray rabbinic thoughts on this much-covered and analyzed action. First, seeing people parading and jubilantly celebrating a death, even a well-deserved death, does not sit especially well with me. This man deserved to be killed, and he was. Fine. Shouting USA loudly, setting off firecrackers, and glorying in this military killing seems kind of preposterous, really. Some have compared the killing of bin Laden to the death of Hitler at the end of World War II. The analogy, if it even needs to be said, is very, very thin. Hitler's death spelled the end of World War II, at least in Europe, the final act in the world's worst trauma ever. Bin Laden's death does not spell the end of terrorism in our world, not by any means, or probably even the end of Al-Qaeda, nor does it end the necessity for vigilance against the scourge of terrorism. So let's be grateful that he's gone, but let's not go around thumping our chests or cheering as though we had completed something wonderful. It was an ugly but very important necessity that he die. Again, that's it. Now, the fact that bin Laden, supposedly hiding in caves in remote and brutally inaccessible mountain country, was openly living in a leafy villa in a pretty town quite near the capital of Pakistan, and that his compound was literally a stone's throw away from the Pakistani version of West Point, highlights some of the problems we still face. Clearly, we finally figured out the right people to bribe in Pakistan, and just as clearly, bin Laden's support on the Muslim street had finally eroded to the point that he could be turned over to the U.S. military without huge negative consequences. This was less a triumph of American initiative than it was a combination of factors, including, no doubt, some serious corruption that permitted a U.S. military operation to be carried out smack in the middle of Pakistan. To me, the most obvious analogy in the killing of bin Laden is the way that it parallels Israel's policy of targeted killings of top Hamas terrorists and other leading murderers. For years, Israel has focused on executing those who have organized, planned, and committed terrorist attacks on Israeli civilians in a proactive way. That Israeli policy and those killings have been roundly and vehemently criticized by world leaders, including some, like the British, who have been busily applauding the death of bin Laden. But what really is the moral difference between eliminating the author of the horrific 9/11 attacks and eliminating the creator of the suicide bombing waves that killed and maimed hundreds of Israelis? Both are necessary acts to combat brutal terrorism. Both take military initiative and planning approved at the highest civilian level, and both require great skill and courage. And both are acts that don't really end terrorism. They just restrain its ability to destroy what we create. So, quiet congratulations are in order for the president and the military, and in particular the Navy SEALs who ran this operation. Again, that's it. In Israel, by the way, they don't dance in the streets when they kill a Hamas terror mastermind. They just quietly go on to the next task at hand. Perhaps we Americans can learn from them. In other news and on other subjects, we have a particularly engaging and delightful guest on Too Jewish Today. He's Lucas Richman, who is shocked that he won a Grammy this year. And here he is conducting Christopher Tin's piece, Hayom Kadosh, Today is Holy, from that Grammy-winning CD, Calling All Dawns. That was Hayom Kadosh, Today is Holy, from the CD Calling All Dawns, conducted by our guest, Lucas Richman. When we return on Too Jewish, we'll meet him, the Grammy-winning conductor and composer, Lucas Richman, a Jewish guy from Southern California who now conducts two symphony orchestras. Find out what it feels like to hear your own name called at a major awards ceremony when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina of Mama's Pizza. When I was in junior high school, the best kisser in the eighth grade was Julie Mills. How did I know she was the best? Well, the truth is, I didn't, because I was pretty shy back then, and including Julie, I only kissed a total of two girls. But to me, with my limited experience, Julie was the best. My point is, we almost never know when something is really the best because we haven't experienced everything else. And so it is with pizza. Sure, every day we hear Mama's Pizza is the best. It feels good to hear it, but still, we don't relax and take it for granted. After all, we're competing with a lot of pizzas out there. So, if you haven't tried Mama's Pizza yet, we humbly invite you to do it today. We believe you will think it's the best, and you'll remember it forever. Just like I remember kissing Julie Mills. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through 8th grade. It has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Judaic studies curriculum, with a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports program THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking skills, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio allows its highly qualified faculty to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in the modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. They are enrolling now. Please give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll your child and to schedule a tour, call 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org. That's 529-3888 for THA. We're delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, Lucas Richman. He served as a music director for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra since 2003 and as music director and conductor for the Bangor Symphony Orchestra since 2010. Lucas Richman received a Grammy Award just a few weeks ago for having conducted the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra on Christopher Tin's classical world fusion album, Calling All Dawns, and won in the category of Best Classical Crossover Album. He's been a guest conductor at many famous orchestras all around the world. Was the assistant and resident conductor for Maris Janssen and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra for 6 years, and before that for the Pacific Symphony Orchestra, and he has collaborated with a variety of classical soloists and crossover works, including working on scores for such films as the Academy Award-nominated The Village, As Good As It Gets, Face Off, Breakdown, The Manchurian Candidate, and Kit Kittredge in American Girl. When you were studying classical music, did you ever think you would be scoring Kit Kittredge in American Girl?
No, I don't think it occurred to me. But I have to say that movie is one of the more beautiful films I've ever worked on. Very, very poignant, and just because it's people think of the American Girl product as being very commercial, the film itself is a very touching one. And very apropos to our financial traumas as a country and in the world right now.
Yeah, it was a Great Depression. I took my daughter to see Porta to see it, and when it came out, and it really does hit home in some funny ways. You have conducted and composed, I think, classical music, but what led you to doing crossover stuff?
Well, I've been actually doing it all my life. I have kept my fingers in both the commercial music world and the classical world. I realized about 15, 20 years ago that if I wanted to still have the opportunities to do classical music, the classical world tends to be very snobbish. And if one gets a reputation as just being a pops conductor or somebody who is a film conductor or composer, then the opportunities for doing classical music are very few and far between. But if I developed a reputation as someone who could do the classical thing with a reasonable amount of integrity, then I would be able to keep doing both. So I'm able to do my Mahler symphonies and my Brahms symphonies and be music director for 2 classical orchestras, but also get involved in recordings and films and musical theater. And this way I get to do everything that I love in the world of music.
With a foot in both worlds and great success in both, we'll be back on Two Jewish with Lucas Richman, the recent recipient of a Grammy, and talk about that on Two Jewish.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation invites you to experience Enduring Eyes, remembering the Holocaust to protect our future. Enduring Eyes is an exhibit of first-hand descriptions and photographs that explores the history of the Holocaust, the atrocities leading up to and during the Holocaust, and emphasizes the importance of protecting our civil rights, a priority the FBI upholds. Enduring Eyes, now showing and free to the public at the Jewish Community Center, 3800 East River Road.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. You don't call, you don't write, or call us at 520-327-4501 or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows by contacting us through the website or downloading us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts. About a month ago, there was a different kind of killing that took place, this one in the West Bank in the Palestinian Authority. Giuliano Merhamis, an outstanding actor, director, filmmaker, and activist working for cooperation and understanding, was gunned down by masked gunmen outside of the Cooperative Freedom Theater he created and ran for children and youth in the Jenin refugee camp. Palestinian police recently arrested a man from the refugee camp. They have charged him with the brutal murder. The tragedy is that Giuliano Merhamis, born to an Israeli Jewish communist mother and a Palestinian Christian Arab communist father, embodied the cause of cooperation and the complexity of Israeli and Palestinian societies. He considered himself, quote, 100% Jewish and 100% Palestinian, unquote. He served in the IDF as a member of the elite paratroopers and became a terrific, incisive film actor. His first movie was a George Roy Hill movie of John le Carré's work, The Little Drummer Girl. He went on to star in a roster of excellent Israeli films, including Under the Domim Tree, the terrific Kippur, and Kedma. Along the way, he founded the Freedom Theater in Jenin with a former leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, that's the terrorist wing of the Fatah, and a Swede and another Israeli. Merhamis worked to teach kids from the Jenin Camp Theater to help them realize their fantasy life on stage to escape the Jenin refugee camp in art. His murder was likely perpetrated by someone motivated to destroy any symbol of cooperation between Jews and Arabs, to thwart any kind of secular celebration of humanity in art. So two deaths to talk about today. One, Osama bin Laden's, is simply about a bad guy who worked to cause destruction and pain and is finally gone. The other, Giuliano Merhamis, is a story about an extraordinary, exceptional human being who had vision and energy and imagination and who worked to understand and to heal. Giuliano Merhamis' death is a tragedy. May his memory be a blessing. And in spite of his murder, may others rise up to take up his causes, to work to bring understanding and healing to the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians. We welcome our maven on Israel, our expert Guy Gelbart from the Israel Center. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Israel's perhaps most delightful holiday, and the one that's the hardest for Americans to pronounce, is coming up, Yom Ha'atzmaut. Tell us about Israel Independence Day.
Yom Ha'atzmaut, Independence Day. Independence Day is probably my favorite because it's a lot of fun, a huge celebration, and we're celebrating it even here in Tucson. We're doing the Israel Festival this year, the 63 Israel Festival. Here in Tucson, we're combining the festival with a huge art fair with a lot of booths, with artists from all around Tucson that comes and, you know, show all their wonderful arts. We have amazing kids activities with crafts, and crafts that are very Israeli-like, like making those sand bottles with colored sand and salt and stuff like that, and a lot of very nice crafts. We are also doing some planting of small, it's not trees, but mint and stuff like that, which comes to educate the young ones about the fire that took place in the Carmel this year and about planting and getting...
nourishing the earth and continuing to rebuild the land.
Exactly. The special event this year at the festival is an amazing dance group that we bring from Israel. Their name is Revital. They're a very famous dance group. They made a performance named Hope, Hatikva, after the Israeli anthem. And in this musical, you might say, it's dancing with videos, with songs, with a lot of costumes changing and everything. They're telling the story of Israel from 1948 till those days, with a lot of color and a vivid experience. So it's really amazing. A lot of fun, a lot of happiness. It's really a fun holiday.
Now, Yom Ha'atzmaut, it's the 63rd anniversary of Israel, and Israel has been celebrating it. It doesn't have to be a 50th or a 60th to come participate. Give us a little preview. Where can people go to join in the Israeli Independence Day celebrations?
Well, here in Tucson, we have the main celebration at the JCC. It will take place on May 15th between 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock. As part of it, this year, for the first time, we're also having a basketball tournament, like a Maccabi basketball tournament for all ages, 4-on-4 teams. And, well, my team won't win, probably, but other teams will.
Another way to celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut, that'll be at the JCC, and that's May...
15th.
May 15th. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Weiler of Janos J Bar and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails is a wonderful new place, maybe the best in Arizona.
Well, we just won Best New Restaurant in Tucson.
I heartily concur. What's your favorite stuff on the menu?
There's so many things that we do well downtown. It's really the foods of the entire world. And so at lunch, we do this great pounded Laotian pounded papaya salad. At dinner, have the trout. Trout with oysters and cream corn. Late night, you got to have the downtown burger.
And you can hear great music there late night too, can't you?
You don't have to go to bed early. You can stay up late Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, listen to live jazz, great specials on the late night menu, great drinks, incredible cocktails we make there, by the way. It's in the name.
I have to say, try the Game Changer Soup, too. What's the phone number for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
623-7700.
Or it's www.downtownkitchen.com.
That's it.
We'll see you there, Janos.
Thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, quite a week in the international news scene with the killing of Osama bin Laden. What are your thoughts? How does this affect things? What happened?
Well, I have many thoughts. I mean, first of all, with all this stuff, you have to be very careful to say the reported killing.
Right. Sorry.
Of someone who is alleged to be Osama bin Laden.
And who allegedly had the same DNA.
Right. And let's hope it was. If all of this were some conspiracy to defraud the public, or even worse, a conspiracy within the government to defraud the White House, we'd be in deep trouble. So let's hope it really is the killing of somebody who really was Osama bin Laden. That being said, There are a lot of angles from which to view this, and I'm not sure which would be of most interest to your listeners. I imagine that one angle is, what's the impact on Israel? Another angle is, what's the impact on Americans and our national security? And another angle is sort of local color. An awful lot of people have asked me, have you ever been to this town of Abbottabad? And, you know, how far is it from the capital? And how could somebody important hide there, et cetera, et cetera? So maybe we'll start with that one and then work our way backward through that list,
yeah,
if
absolutely.
That's all right with
that,
you.
That definitely occurred to me when I saw that.
Okay. I mean, actually, I have friends whom you know who visited me in Pakistan and are now in Israel for one of their 2-3 month visits per year and sent me an email saying, were we there while we were in Pakistan? And they did indeed pass through Abbottabad twice on their way to and from the Principality of Swat in the far northern mountains. So they were in that town. And I was there primarily one time, not just passing through, but because the Primo Prep School, where all the most wealthy Pakistanis send their kids if their kids are bright enough to get in all of Pakistan, is located there. And one of the instructors made all of the Pakistani dailies because he was celebrating his 50th anniversary of teaching at that school. And he had been there since Pakistani independence and previously had been teaching at the Military Academy of British India, which was a school where both Indian and Pakistani and ultimately Bangladeshi senior officers all had their early education together. They were all schoolmates, and they still get together for reunions, even though they're three countries which have often worse than tense relations.
Been at violent war, right. We might say.
So anyway, I spent a day in Abbottabad, found this school, interviewed this very elderly gentleman who was a product of Oxford, Cambridge, Eton, whatever, all those finest British schools. And he referred to, you know, his old boys, meaning former students, who were in many cases ministers or even retired ministers of Pakistan. And it was very interesting because he clearly was only aware of the Pakistan that existed within the walls of this, they call it a college, it's actually a high school. And that was the remnants of a very different Pakistan, really from the late 40s and the early 50s. And the clock sort of all stood still there. There's also a Pakistani military academy. It's a fairly sizable town with a lot of wealthy people who live in these big compounds. It's very common in Pakistan for anybody with money, whether they're a public official or military or just a private business person,
or a huge international terrorist,
to live in a house that's behind high walls with a lot of levels of security to keep out common thieves. Pakistan's a very poor country, and people with money don't necessarily want their homes to be visible from the streets. Anyway, so much for local color. We should probably continue next week.
And we will. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then. And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A very short joke this week. Why do Jewish husbands die before their wives? They want to. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, but please don't tell your wife that joke. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Behar from the book of Leviticus, which establishes the rules for the sabbatical and jubilee years, the most important form of environmental legislation in the ancient world. Concern for the environment in Judaism has always been an important part of our tradition. The very first text on caring for the natural world goes all the way back to Genesis, where we are commanded to be stewards of God's creation. But the most critical Jewish legislation in the Torah is found in Leviticus. In this section we read this week in Behar, "You shall have a sabbatical every seventh year, and the land shall rest. We are instructed to do no active planting or cultivation, to allow the fields to lie fallow, to give the earth a chance to rest. This is considered today to be good, practical agricultural policy. It allows time for nature to restore the nutrients that grains leach from the soil, allows the fallen fruit in the orchard to nourish the loam. It is a fundamental part of crop rotation in all areas practicing modern farming. The remarkable fact about this Shemitah, this sabbatical mitzvah, is that it originated in the Torah, a document that is at least 2,500 years old, and it contains text that is quite probably 700 or 800 years older than that. That is, the scientific concern for the health of the environment goes back 3,000 years in Judaism, and the requirement to care for the natural world as responsible human beings is at least as long-standing. There are many more commandments in the Torah relating to stewardship of the natural world. Even in warfare, we are prohibited from destroying our enemy's fruit trees or seriously damaging the productive capacity of the land. This is in sharp contrast to the ancient Roman Empire's policy of sowing salt in the fields of conquered enemies to destroy their fields and to create forced starvation. Ironically, it is also in contrast to the sometimes policy of the Israeli military to bulldoze the olive trees of Arab terrorists' families. The injunction is clear. We are to respect the natural environment, since it is a reflection of God's holiness projected into our world. There are contemporary consequences of this most ancient commandment. The sabbatical year off from teaching, so beloved on university campuses, comes directly from this week's portion of Bahar. It's a time to recharge your batteries, renew your scholarship, just as the land replenishes itself through a year of Shemitah, divine rest. It's a great lesson in a world in which we often seem more intent on domination than cultivation. May we learn Bahar's lesson and so allow our land to renew itself. And then we might even learn to allow ourselves some rest, and so come to replenish our own spiritual resources, you know, like with Shabbat. When we come back, we'll talk with the delightful Lucas Richman, a Grammy Award winner this year and the composer and conductor of wonderful classical music, including a variety of Jewish compositions. Meet him, find out how he won his Grammy in just a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Rival Palestinian factions Fatah and Hamas signed a unity agreement in a formal ceremony last week, repairing, perhaps, the four-year rift between them. The ceremony in Cairo was delayed for 2 hours over the crucial issue of whether the head of the Islamist Hamas, Khalid Mashal, should sit on the stage and be allowed to speak. "The signing of this unity deal turns the black page of division," said Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, head of Fatah, following the signing at the Egyptian intelligence headquarters. That is not an oxymoron. "Our battle is with the Israeli enemy and not with Palestinian factions," Hamas's Khalid Mashal said, following Abbas. "The reconciliation agreement will form an interim Fatah-Hamas government to run the West Bank." That should be very interesting. It is now controlled by the Palestinian Authority, and also to run the Hamas-run Gaza Strip. Parliamentary and presidential elections will take place within a year. Abbas has said he will not be a candidate. The document was signed in front of members of Egypt's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which has governed Egypt since Hosni Mubarak was deposed in January. Arab members of Israel's Knesset also attended the signing. In an interview with Israel Radio shortly before the signing, Nabil Shath, a senior Abbas aide, said it was unfair for international leaders, including the Mideast Quartet, to demand that Hamas recognize Israel. Oh my. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called on Abbas to halt the agreement. I call on Abu Mazen to annul the agreement with Hamas immediately and choose the path of peace with Israel, Netanyahu told Tony Blair during their meeting to discuss the stalled peace process and other diplomatic issues, including the elimination of Osama bin Laden. The agreement between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas is a hard blow to the peace process, said Netanyahu. How is it possible to achieve peace with a government, half of which calls for the destruction of the State of Israel and even praises the arch-murderer Osama bin Laden? Well, we'll see how long this new accord lasts. In other news, some 24 Palestinians gathered in the Gaza Strip to pay tribute to Osama bin Laden. About 25 people holding pictures and posters of bin Laden rallied outside of Gaza City University. The crowd included al-Qaeda sympathizers as well as students who said they opposed bin Laden's ideology but were angry at the U.S. for killing him and considered him, you guessed it, a martyr. In the weeks ahead of bin Laden's death, a survey of the Arab world by the Pew Research Center found support for the al-Qaeda leader had dropped dramatically in recent years, but that it remained highest among good old Palestinians. The survey said about a third of Palestinians believe bin Laden would do the right thing in world affairs. This was still a dramatic drop from a few years ago. Ismail Haniyeh, prime minister of Gaza's Hamas government, condemned the U.S. operation against bin Laden, whom he hailed as a Muslim and Arab warrior. Still, the Islamic Hamas has always distanced itself from al-Qaeda, saying its battle is against Israel, not the West. Al-Qaeda supporters have often accused Hamas of being too moderate and clashed with them. Israel's Channel 2 TV broadcast video from Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque compound last Tuesday, that's Islam's third holiest site in the world, showing a Palestinian preacher mourning bin Laden, calling him a hero and a lion of Islam, cursing President Barack Obama and hurling insults at Pope John Paul II. Why curse the late Pope John Paul II, you ask? Good question. The irrationality of those who hate simply knows no bounds. Ironically, just a week after we reported on the 50th anniversary of the Eichmann trial and Deborah Lipstadt's new book about it, former Israeli Supreme Court President Moshe Landau, who presided over the Eichmann trial, died at the age of 99. May he rest in peace. And while most of the world, 2 billion of the close to 7 billion souls on the planet, according to some reports, I don't actually believe them, by the way, anyway, they gloried in watching the royal wedding ceremony for Prince William and Kate Middleton in London, but there was one disappointment. Many reports before the nuptials said that the very in-tune royal couple was going to include a variety of multi-ethnic and perhaps even religious elements in their wedding, and that one of these was going to be the Jewish breaking of the glass at the end of the wedding. But alas, for anyone who watched the ceremony, there was only disillusionment in the end, for Westminster Abbey did not echo to cries of Mazel Tov when the royal Will stomped on the glass, because he didn't. Perhaps the Archbishop of Canterbury refused to permit the glass breaking. Maybe another lord confiscated the glass, or maybe it was just wishful thinking on the part of British Jewry. Well, anyway, we're mildly disappointed that Wills and Kate didn't break the glass, but perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. After all, there was a long tradition in the royal family that each and every boy was circumcised not by a pediatrician or urologist, but by an Orthodox Jewish rabbi who was a moyle. It was true for King George, it was true for Prince Charles. But Prince Charles chose differently for his son, and the first British royal boy not to be circumcised by a moyle in many, many years was Prince William himself. No bris, and now no glass breaking. Ah, so sad. Now I'll bet that's an angle on the most overcovered wedding ever that you haven't heard before. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Lucas Richmond. He's the music director for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra and music director and conductor for the Bangor Symphony Orchestra. I guess you've got kind of the whole East Coast between you there. He received a Grammy just recently in 2011 for having conducted the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra on a classical world fusion album of Christopher Tin's Calling All Dawns. He won the category of Best Classical Crossover Album. Most recently, Lucas Richmond was invited by John Williams to serve as the conductor for a national summer tour of Star Wars in concert. He actually conducted that here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. An accomplished composer, he's had his music performed by over 200 orchestras in the last 10 years, and his works written specifically for children have been featured in young people's concerts all throughout the country. What do you like better, conducting, composing classical music, or working in the more popular sphere?
It's really hard for me to make a choice. Conducting is recreative, if you think about it. You're recreating someone else's initial creative inspiration, whereas composing is creative. And I like to have a balance of both, the creative and the recreative. I enjoy conducting my own works. in everything that I do, I like to make sure that we're telling some sort of story, conveying something that touches upon the emotional experience that people bring into the concert hall or people bring into the theater when they watch a film. Whatever it is, whatever medium it is, as long as there's some sort of connection that I'm able to achieve. I really enjoy it all.
Who are your favorite composers? Who influenced you the most?
I would say as a mentor, Leonard Bernstein was very influential in my life. I had the incredible opportunity to know him in the last 10 years of his life. I met him originally at Tanglewood when I was 16, and then was in a master class when I was 18 in the LA Philharmonic Institute. I have this 45-minute videotape of him instructing me in Brahms' Academic Festival Overture. And turns out that piece then was assigned to me by him to conduct when I was 24 on tour in Russia and Germany and London on the Schleswig-Holstein Music Festival, where I was one of four conductors to go around doing these concerts with him during this festival. Quite an extraordinary man and composer, teacher, conductor. Everything that he was about was teaching. And I certainly try to emulate that in what I do, always talking about the power of music. It's always the people who are aware of the younger generations that will have the greater reach and the longevity with their legacy. Aaron Copland was also a towering force in the classical music scene. And when I was 6 years old, I wrote a letter to Aaron Copland, and my parents said, "Don't expect an answer back from him." as I was reading biographies of composers, and I couldn't believe it. I would read about Beethoven and Bach and Mozart, and when I got to the end of these books, the composer was always dead. So, being six, I thought, in order to be a composer, you have to be dead.
In order to be a composer, you have to be decomposed.
Exactly. But when I got to the end of Aaron Copland's book, at the time, he was very much alive, and I couldn't believe it. So I wrote a letter to him, and he answered back. 6 weeks later, I got a postcard from Aaron Copland, and that reaching out to a little kid growing up in the San Fernando Valley, California, meant so much over my time, my musical life. That kind of reaching out, that mentorship is what it's all about. And those are the people that truly have the biggest impact on the next generations.
You know, it stuns me the number of classical musicians I've spoken to who somehow were mentored, directly inspired by Leonard Bernstein in one class or another. I mean, it's really fantastic being able to do that. Did that inspire you to get so involved in writing young people's music?
I would say that the things I've written for educational concerts came as a result of the fact that I was in a position of conducting educational concerts. Very often I would want to teach a particular lesson and found that I just didn't have the right piece to teach the lesson. For instance, for an orchestration concert, when you're meeting the orchestra, I couldn't find a piece that was just the orchestral winds. People often do a piece by Dvorak, his Serenade for Winds, but there are horns and contrabass, not pure three flutes, three oboes, three clarinets, three bassoons, just the woodwind section. So I wrote a piece, and that developed into a whole larger work called the United Symphony, where I demonstrate each of the families of the instruments. So things kind of come out of the desire to teach a particular lesson. And that's, I had the extraordinary opportunity to write and over 40 pieces and have them played by the Pittsburgh Symphony in my 6 years in Pittsburgh. The catalog has just expanded basically because I've been doing those educational concerts and love the teaching.
You know, so many outstanding instrumentalists and composers, conductors are Jewish. Is there something Jewish about classical music?
It's interesting that you say that. I think that a lot of it stems originally from the family ethic. There was a closeness, a desire to achieve that was really part of the Jewish tradition. And you find that with the Asian community as well, where the next generation of real high achieving classical artists were the Asian community. And I believe that that is largely due to the tight infrastructure of the family in those particular cultures.
I assume probably high expectations within the family.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that, you know what, the recognition that, listen, music has been a huge part of the Jewish experience. Personally, when I go to shul, it's not always a spiritual experience, but I go more for the tradition and the heritage. I love the melodies that I hear and the sense of community. And the idea of that legacy, that line continuing is a very big part of the Jewish experience as far as I'm concerned.
You know, as a cantor, I like hearing that because so much of Jewish tradition is musical, although, of course, so much of it was vocal for a long time. You didn't hear instruments in the synagogue. Broad range. Have you ever composed anything specifically for the synagogue?
Oh, I've written quite extensively in Judaica. I have written on all subjects from setting traditional liturgy. For my own wedding, I did a setting of the Sheva Brachot, the seven blessings, for tenor or soprano and chamber ensemble, to various pieces on the Holocaust, settings of the Last Butterfly,
the beautiful poems from Theresienstadt.
Yeah, from Theresienstadt. And the Dachau lead, taking the song by Herbert Zipper that was he wrote in Dachau, an extraordinary anthem that became a rallying song for the prisoners, and turned that into a companion piece to Arnold Schoenberg's Survivor from Warsaw, with same orchestration, men's chorus, a narrator, and orchestra. And the one piece that actually I'm a lot of people seem to know me for is my Hanukkah Festival Overture, which was commissioned by the Pacific Symphony in Orange County, California, back in 1994. Every year, 25 to 30 orchestras play it around the country. It's a fun little piece, about 6 minutes long, that takes some of the more traditional Hanukkah tunes and brings it into the winter holiday atmosphere.
So, a very important question. How fun is it to win a Grammy Award?
Oh, it was a real delight, and I think, in a way, better because I didn't expect it to happen. I really wasn't even sure that I was nominated. I didn't really know. I knew that the album had been nominated for two Grammys, but I didn't know that if I qualified to be in a Grammy winner. But as it turns out, in this particular category, or several categories, I guess, you have to have performed on 51%, at least 51% of the album. And that's what I did as the conductor. So I was essentially the performer leading the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. They performed everything. But that's... But, you know, you go into a project like this not...
I'm going to win a Grammy for doing that.
Yeah, no. Christopher Tin wrote an extraordinary collection of songs. Each track is in a different language, ranging from Japanese and Chinese. And the first track is a song called Baba Yetu. It's a setting of the Lord's Prayer in Swahili, sung by the Soweto Gospel Choir. It's a tremendous piece. Federico von Stada sings a Polish aria. There's a piece in a song in Hebrew right next to something in Persian, and it really is a telling of, in a very spiritual way, of a life cycle from morning through the evening and back to morning again. And I listen to it and I still tear up because of the raw earthiness of this wonderful, wonderful music he wrote.
How fun. So how do you find out? Does somebody call you? Do they send you an email?
I got a letter inviting me as a nominee to the
Grammy Awards.
So I thought, oh, I guess I did get a nomination.
well, mazel tov.
Thank you.
I want to thank Lucas Richmond for a delightful visit here on Too Jewish. You can find more about his compositions at ledorgroup.com, ledorgroup.com.
Ledor Group.
Ledor Vador, from generation to generation. Ah.
Exactly.
Much better. You know, you think a rabbi would get that. At ledorgroup.com. Thanks, Lucas, and continued success.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
When we come back, we're about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Cantor Bruce Rubin, who is the head of the School of Sacred Music of Hebrew Union College. Our playout this morning, perhaps a trifle unseasonable, but quite lovely nonetheless, is from our Grammy-winning guest, Lucas Richmond, and his composition, The Hanukkah Festival Overture. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.